From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Research shows that minority students are more likely to face disciplinary action in school than white students. When students face more detentions, suspensions, and expulsions than their white counterparts, we also see more children of color in juvenile and criminal courts. That phenomenon is often called the school-to-prison pipeline. Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening of District 5, which is New Hanover and Pender Counties, spends his days hearing cases related to kids, cases of abuse and neglect, delinquency, with children under the age of 16. Over the past 5 years, Judge Korpening has attended local, state, and national conferences focused on stemming the school-to-prison pipeline. He takes an active role in overseeing District 5's teen court, which last year saw about 180 student volunteers in the program, and he is a recent recipient of a national award, the David W. Sukup Judge of the Year Award, presented at the National Court-Appointed Special Advocates Conference on March 11th. Judge Korpening, welcome to Coastline and congratulations on the award.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning, Rachel.
Glad to have you here. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. What do you think local leaders can do to help prevent juvenile recidivism? Do you have experience with the juvenile justice system? Since this live Wednesday discussion is taking place during the last day of our spring pledge drive, we can't take phone calls today, but we welcome your questions and comments at coastline@whqr.org. Judge Korpening, how would you characterize the whole idea of the school-to-prison pipeline? Is it a liberal issue? And I ask that because there are a lot of advocacy groups out there writing about this, including the ACLU. With the recent research around this, is it getting across the board acknowledgement or is it a liberal issue?
It's getting across the board acknowledgement. And one of the best examples I can give you about that is with the recent Raise the Age effort in North Carolina. You know, our school justice partnerships were part of Raise the Age. And the coalition that came together to support that is across the spectrum. Representatives from the ACLU, the John Locke Foundation, Conservatives for Criminal Justice Reform, all sitting at the same tables together, advocating for what's right for kids. So the name suggests a liberal agenda, but the work does not. And I think that advocacy groups across the spectrum have come together on that.
And for those folks who aren't familiar with Raise the Age, North Carolina was one of the last states in the country to—
The last.
It was after New York.
After New York.
Okay, so there we are. Tell us what it does.
So Raise the Age raises the age of jurisdiction for kids to be adults in criminal court. Since time began, really, kids have been adults in our criminal justice system at age 16. We're the last state to have that. New York raised it just ahead of us. It fails to take into consideration brain science, fails to take into consideration the stupid kids stuff that kids for generations have done. And in December 2019, that's going to be raised so that kids become adults in the criminal justice system at age 18, which will be a fabulous change. The support for that was incredibly broad-based. I think the vote on the House floor was 104-8, if that gives you an idea of across-the-spectrum support. Of course, the final version was in the Senate budget bill, but broad-based support across the spectrum for doing right by kids.
And why is it important for a child to be in the juvenile justice system? What's the difference for that kid, and how would that possibly change his trajectory?
Several differences. First is that in the juvenile justice system, we have a problem-solving model. We assess the risks and needs of every young person who comes our way, and then we match services to meet those needs and to address those risks. In the adult criminal justice system, we don't have those kinds of resources. Probation officers have caseloads that are too high, but the assessments, the detailed assessments and the treatment we have are not available in the adult system. In addition, as part of that, we've got authority over parents in the juvenile justice system. I can order a parent to participate. I can order a parent to get their child to treatment. Right now in the criminal justice system at 16, a probation officer can't talk to a parent of a 16-year-old unless there's a release sign, because that child's an adult in the criminal system. That's hard. But then the other big impact for our kids, and the reason it's important for 16 and 17 year olds to be in the juvenile justice system, is that they get a scarlet letter when they get charged or convicted of a criminal offense. That affects college admission. It affects job searches, job availability, and that's a tough target for a kid to carry from 16. You know, lots of the listeners, you know, may have experienced something when they were 16 or 17 that they wish hadn't happened, that maybe they didn't get caught for.
Right.
They learned from the experience, but they didn't get caught for it.
And maybe mom and dad helped bail them out or fix it or remedy the situation so they're not getting door slammed in their face when they're 18.
Right, because that door slamming can continue well into life. We've had 40 and 50-year-olds coming to us seeking relief from something that happened when they were teenagers because it's affecting their ability to get a job in their 40s and 50s. A misdemeanor, a silly misdemeanor, something that...
And no criminal history from that point on?
No criminal history from that point on.
So decades of living a crime-free life, and they're still getting impacted.
Can affect employability, yes.
So help us understand this school-to-prison pipeline that we're talking about. If a student who happens to be a minority is facing discipline frequently in school, is that a pretty good predictor that that child will wind up in the criminal justice system later on?
Yes. The research on exclusionary school discipline, both through suspension and through referrals to court, shows us that once you start down that pathway, it increases the likelihood of repetition of that pathway. So once a kid starts getting suspended, more likely to be suspended again, more likely to end up getting charged, more likely to end up getting charged again, and it goes on all the way to more likely to be in jail, hence school-to-prison pipeline.
Now, why is this disproportionately impacting children of color?
So that's, I guess that's the million-dollar question. You know, one answer is implicit bias.
Do you mean racism?
So, no. You know, in the districts that I've worked, I haven't seen racism, and I view implicit bias differently than racism. Racism, for me, is an open hatred, an open discrimination, whereas implicit bias is something we may not even be aware of. And I think that bears out in many of the statistics that I look at. And that's one of the reasons that as we look at partnerships to formally agree on how we respond to student misconduct, we have the ability to remove discretion and limit the impact of implicit bias.
Limit discretion of, say, a teacher? Is that what you mean?
No, limit the discretion on folks who are making the disciplinary decisions. And limit it, for example, in saying, so you can't automatically charge for this type of offense. You can't automatically do that.
Give us an example.
Sure. So two boys get in a fight over a girl. We've agreed that that's not going to automatically be charged and sent to court. Is that a safety issue for school? Probably not. Can some school fights turn a school inside out? Yes, and they need to be addressed differently. But for minor offenses like that, especially two boys who then want to have lunch together the same day, but the response historically has been automatically charge, automatically suspend for 10 days. And let's be honest, a 10-day suspension from school is a really harsh punishment from my view. And I've been a punisher in my life, and that's a harsh punishment. You know, my son had a surgery in the eighth grade, had to miss 3 or 4 days of school, and it took us weeks to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that was him believing that if he didn't do the work, he wouldn't have to do the work. But still, it took us a couple of weeks to catch up. I can't imagine trying to recover from 10 days out.
Now, in your example of two boys getting into a fight at school, are we talking about children of color versus white kids? Like if two white boys got into a fight at school, are they less likely to get that 10-day suspension?
So in my specific example, I don't know that I can answer that. But as we look at disciplinary statistics, we can say, yes, children of color are more likely to be treated with exclusionary types of discipline, more likely to be suspended than their white counterparts, more likely to be charged than their white counterparts. And
so you're saying part of that's implicit bias driving that.
I think that has to play a big role in it because the people that I work with in this school system and in other school systems are are fine people. They want the best for kids. But we're also recovering from 3 decades of exclusionary school discipline practices that started with zero tolerance in the 80s. Zero tolerance in the criminal justice system started with the drug wars, spread into other parts of the criminal justice system, spread into our juvenile justice system, spread into the schools, was ramped up by Columbine in 99. So we're trying to recover from all of that. So the automatic charging, automatic suspending sort of became a way of life. And I think that by intentionally responding to that issue and agreeing to put other measures in place before charging, that we can impact it.
And is that something, that zero tolerance policy, is that no longer in place, or is that a gradual phase out? What's the status of that in schools now?
So the official policy of our school system is that zero tolerance doesn't exist.
Do you think that there are some people in school that would take issue with that?
I think that there are some folks who would take issue with whether that's accurate or not in mm-hmm. some portions of our school system. You know, we've got, I don't know, 30-some schools, however many schools we've got, with building administrators that are different in every building. And there might be some disagreement about, but the official policy is that we don't automatically do that. They're also working to address suspensions, and I know that there's some concern from the community that enough hasn't been done on suspensions.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking with Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening about the school-to-prison pipeline and what the challenges are in stemming the disproportionately high flow of children of color into the criminal justice system. What questions do you have for Judge Korpening? You can send them during this live Wednesday discussion to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're talking with Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening, who has ascended to national recognition with an award earlier this month, the David W. Sukup Award for Judge of the Year. Our focus on this Wednesday discussion is the school-to-prison pipeline, how it came to be, what local officials are trying to implement to get kids back on the right track, and what some of those options are available. You can ask your own question of Judge Korpening on this Wednesday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Judge Korpening, you talked a little bit in the first segment about implicit bias. What are some of the cultural differences that children of color have versus white students in, for example, perhaps the way they respond to teachers or behave in class, or the way a white teacher might perceive a child of color?
So I think that cultural competency involves lots of different things. And some of that may be how we define culture, because, you know, for example, kids in poverty may respond differently to stressors at school than kids who don't live in poverty. You know, we have kids in elementary school in our community who are coming to school after having hidden under their beds because of gunfire outside their house overnight. Well, those kids are going to respond differently. And I think as teachers and administrators, as judges, we all have to be aware of who we're dealing with and what's driving the behavior, not what did you just do, but what just happened to you. What just happened is a great question to ask instead of why did you do this, what just happened. And I think that there's training out there for cultural competency, there's training out there on implicit bias, and I think that whether we're working with kids in the school system or in the court system or wherever we intersect with kids, we've got to be more competent culturally. Are there some cultures that are very, very different than ours in our community? When I say ours, the sort of traditional, you know, white Anglo-Saxon community, yes, there are so many different cultures that are part of our society. We are absolutely a melting pot. But especially for folks like me, as a white male, I've got to be sensitive to those other cultures. I've got to be sensitive to what may be driving behavior that isn't present in my life, but is clearly present in a child's life that I'm dealing with. And I've got to be competent about that.
When you ask that question, what just happened as a response to reactive behavior or a child acting up? Just even the feel of that question is so different. It seems like it's the opposite of a school administrator or a teacher having their own reactive response.
Yes, and I'll tell you that I'm seeing lots of change in our administrators, lots of evolution. I'm really proud of what's happening in our schools because lots of our building administrators are really changing their mindset about how to respond to kids and are asking the what just happened question instead of why did you do this or what did you just do. But lots of times there's a what just happened to you. Yeah. That's there that we need to know about because that can be driving the behavior. A great example is, you know, we've had kids bringing weapons to school for years, especially knives, where we automatically responded in a particular way. No one was asking the what just happened question. And in asking the what just happened question, we learned that some of these kids are carrying them because they're afraid, because they're being beat up on the way home or they're beat up on the way to school and they're afraid and they don't feel like they've got an adult they can turn to. That's a very different scenario than a kid who's bringing a knife to school to hurt someone.
Now, you mentioned that you are seeing changes in understanding and changes in cultural perceptions among what we're calling the white majority right now. You've had your own evolution in terms of perceptions around what you would call implicit bias. 20 years ago or 30 years ago, how different were you?
So I went on the bench in 1991, 27 and a half years ago now. And in the early to mid-90s, I was a punisher, but lots of folks in my role were. There was lots of belief that you could lock up problems and make it better, lock up problems and fix the problem. Even with drug addicts, there was a belief that in the criminal justice system that if we locked up the problem, that would fix things. And nothing could have been further from the truth. And I joked with you earlier, and I've joked sometimes doing presentations, that then at some point in my career I learned to read. And I started looking at what the impact of what we were doing really was on people long term. And fortunately, more research came out, more research has been done. And it's important for all of us who are involved with children to take advantage of that work and to learn from our mistakes, bluntly, and to respond in a different way. Had to do that both in the criminal justice system and my response to folks now in juvenile justice, my response to young folks, but also in my DSS world in response to things like opiate addiction. You know, an evolution for me was that I didn't believe in medication-assisted treatment. I told folks they had to clean meant clean and that they couldn't be on mat. And how wrong I was when I learned from addiction specialists who were in the business of treating that medication-assisted treatment is the gold standard in responding to opiate addiction. But yet, I and others were saying, no, you can't have that available to you. It helped me learn that judges shouldn't dictate treatment. Treatment folks need to dictate treatment. So that was a part of my evolution, too.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening about his work stemming the tide of minority kids into the criminal justice system. What do you think could keep kids in school? What's the missing piece in diverting the school-to-prison pipeline back into school? Do you have experience in the juvenile justice system? Tell us about it on this Wednesday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Alan writes, I moved to North Carolina from Connecticut 2 years ago, and Connecticut Incorporated raised the age into its judicial system several years ago. Critical to raise the age success is adequate support services and an understanding that non-criminal behavior like truancy must be addressed at early ages. Judge Korpening, what would an example of how might you address truancy in sort of a non-punishing way?
So that's a great question. We've had a truancy council in New Hanover County for more than a dozen years to address attendance issues for kids in elementary school. It's a partnership between courts and school system and DSS, mental health, and we work to resolve those barriers to attendance early on because we know that students learn to go to school. Not only do they learn in school, but they learn to go to school. Converse is they learn not to go to school. And so by middle school and high school, if they've learned to go to school, then they'll be in school. And so we've tried to address truancy early on and to try to address it in a positive way by addressing barriers to attendance and then working together supportively to help the parents remove the barriers to attendance.
What are some of those barriers?
So, for example, we had a mom one day who wasn't getting, she had, I think, four or five kids. She had a car with two car seats. She couldn't even transport all her kids at one time. There was one bed in the house. The car worked sometimes. You know, and so DSS got involved, not to remove her children, but to be a support service. Some community organizations got involved. She was able to get a vehicle with enough seats for all of her children with adequate car seats. She was able to get enough beds. And her kids started going to school. That's an example. Sometimes it's unmet mental health needs, and we're able to use our mental health team member to recommend access to services for the parent who may be clinically depressed, can't get up out of bed in the morning because of tragedies in their life, because of unemployment, deaths in their family, but unmet mental health needs. And so we work to try to address that and to make sure those services are available. Sometimes the ability to pick up a phone and ask for help is a barrier. Folks are proud. Folks don't want to admit that there's an issue. They don't want to ask for help because then that's a sign of weakness. All of us at a time in our life need help and need to ask. And so that's a message we try to convey in a positive way to the folks that we work with. One of the things that I'm sort of transitioning to the rest of the question from the gentleman who moved from Connecticut is that we haven't criminalized truancy in North Carolina in decades. Mm-hmm. Kids don't go to jail for truancy. In some states, they do. We don't lock up status offenders in North Carolina. We treat it as a family problem. We try to address it through resources. The kid can come in as an undisciplined kid, but that's important. That's an important distinction between North Carolina and some other states. One other thing about Connecticut that I can't resist is that Connecticut did a really good job of adopting school justice partnerships. When Connecticut raised the age of juvenile jurisdiction, they adopted school justice partnerships statewide. And so I think Connecticut gets a gold star from me.
And I'm going to ask you what that is in just a moment. But first of all, school resource officers have been on the rise over the last several years in response to violent incidents at school, school shootings. Is the increase of school resource officers in public schools, is that contributing to getting more kids diverted into the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system?
So I think the direct answer is yes, it has contributed, because before there were school resource officers, then somebody had to be called to the school, had to do a report, had to do an investigation, and then make a decision to charge or not. So to some extent, yes, but then that's why it's important to have partnership agreements that says, well, but instead of charging automatically, we're going to do something different. We're going to divert to teen court, or we're going to do some problem-solving work at the school. We're going to implement services that we've got here on site. We're going to match young person to a school-based therapist to address maybe some unmet mental health needs. And so I think that that's important. Second piece that's important about that is to make sure that school resource officers are trained in their role, because school resource officers are not patrol officers.
What's the difference?
The difference is that school resource officers are there to build relationships with students, to be a positive role model for students, to be a positive force and intervention at school, and then, yes, in case of an emergency, to be a safety resource. But their primary mission is relationship building, to build trust among the students to help improve school climate. I've seen that. I've got friends who have said that a school resource officer was the reason their child graduated from high school.
And can you give us an example of what that SRO might have done that would have made a difference?
SRO made a personal relationship with the young person. SRO was available as a check-in. If there were questions, if there were concerns, if there was something going on in the school day, every student in our school needs some adult in that building that they can confide in, that they can talk to if something's not right in their life or at school. And lots of times school resource officers who are well-trained can be that person, which is a powerful, positive influence as opposed to our normal thought about law enforcement. You know, there is lots of difference of opinion about, you know, whether we should have police in schools at all. I think they're there to stay. And so then my focus is let's make sure they're trained. In New Hanover County, they're well trained.
And is part of that training mental health awareness training?
Yes. So all of our school resource officers have been trained in CIT, crisis intervention training, and how to respond to folks who are in crisis. You know, bad stories coming from some other places about law enforcement response to mentally ill, where tragedies happen.
We saw a video. Was this last year? I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago. But this student, a teenager in South Carolina Public right. School, who was told by the SRO to put her cell phone down, she didn't comply. And then this shocking video of right. her getting essentially attacked by the SRO, and the desk upended, and she's on the floor. I mean, it was shocking and violent.
Right. And so I think that the CIT training, and I may be saying that wrong, but I think it's crisis intervention training, that's a how to respond to folks who may be in a crisis is important. Our school resource officers have that. All of our school resource officers also have youth mental health first aid training. So they are trained to look for signs and symptoms of something more serious that's going on with our young people that may need a mental health intervention. In addition to that, they get training every year that's done within the Sheriff's Department on school resource officer role and responsibility, on how to respond to kids, on and then, yes, on more serious things, if they have to respond to something like an active shooter, they're also trained on that. So, but I'm proud of the training that happens within our Sheriff's Department. You know, our Sheriff, Ed McMahon, was a school resource officer earlier in his career. So that's a special place. He has a special place in his heart for our resource officers, and I think to a large extent make sure that they're well-trained.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening about his work to stem the tide of children of color flowing into the criminal justice system. What do you think could keep kids in school? What's the missing piece for you? Let us know by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org during this live Wednesday discussion. We have a question. Sarah from Wilmington writes, "We recently experienced overt displays of bias against LGBT kids of color with legislation like HB2. She writes, "Not only was there implicit bias against the kids due to their race, but also explicit bias against them due to their sexual orientation or gender identity. Has that led to an increase of LGBT kids of color entering the criminal justice pipeline? And have community clinics like WHAT and Coastal Horizons had an effect on decreasing the pipeline into the criminal justice system?"
So we have not seen that increase here. Our schools have a policy of non-discrimination, and it's a very clear policy. And are those kids at one of the groups at risk? Yes, one of the four highest at-risk groups for facing exclusionary school discipline. So that's something we have to watch for, but I'm thankful that we have not seen that increase here. I'm also thankful that we've got a WHAT clinic in every one of our traditional high schools now. Hoggard opened its clinic this fall. Another bandwagon I have is I believe we need mental health services available in every single school.
We know that a lack of parental involvement early on in a kid's life increases that child's chances of needing intervention of other kinds. And unfortunately, children of color and children who are in poverty suffer more from lack of parental involvement. But we also hear so much about teachers who are overwhelmed by the need. If every effort should be made to keep kids in school, talk now to that teacher who is overwhelmed and exhausted and at the end of her rope and didn't know that she was signing up to become the be-all and end-all for children when she thought she was going to teach biology.
Sure. So the first part of the answer to that question is that I've talked to the dean at Watson College of Education about being more intentional in the curriculum for new teachers in classroom management and response to behavior. I think that in fairness to our teachers, they need that training because they go to school to learn how to be a teacher. They walk into a classroom and no one's paid attention to the fact they've got to manage behavior of any number of students within that classroom, or at least not enough attention's been paid to that. Second part of that is that it's incumbent on the schools to offer training to the teachers about redirection, about classroom management, about resources that are available to them. We have a number of our schools that are PBIS schools, Positive Behavior Intervention and Support schools, where there's a three-tier, a pyramid that's got three tiers for responding to behavior. There are tools available at those schools to address the behavior that teachers can take advantage of. I think more attention needs to be paid in offering teachers tools like restorative justice models. Some of our schools are starting to do morning meetings with their kids, which is a variant of restorative circles, where the day starts with a positive note, with building trust between the kids and the teachers, between the kids themselves, but also between the kids and the teachers. And I think that we need to pay more attention to building resources like that.
What is that? Paint the picture of such a meeting.
So restorative circles and restorative justice models have been used all over the world, and we've actually got some local experts. Dr. Kim Cook at UNCW is one of those experts. But restorative circles are used to bring folks together in a time of sharing about what's happening in their lives. I've experienced circles a few times. It was a very powerful model for me. I didn't know what to expect. I thought, these adults sitting in this circle are going to share, sure thing, right? And then it's a very powerful experience. And for a trained facilitator to guide that discussion, they start with very generic questions, asking folks to share, and then ask people to share something like, what's heavy on your heart today? Which is an opportunity to talk about yourself or someone else that you're concerned about. Great model.
Sounds like what just happened. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening about the school-to-prison pipeline, the embedded challenges in trying to reverse that flow, what local leaders are doing. When we come back, you'll have one more segment to get your question or comment into the live Wednesday discussion. You can do that today by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we'll hear from Don. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're meeting Chief District Court Judge Jay Korpening today. He's from District 5, New Hanover and Pender Counties. We're talking about why a disproportionately high number of minority kids wind up in a phenomenon frequently referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline. This is the last segment, so you have a few minutes left to send your own question or comment to coastline@whqr.org during this live Wednesday discussion. We have an email from Don who writes, to what or whom, if anything or anyone, can you attribute to your current insight and perspective on this issue that may have caused you to change your approach to the treatment of these at-risk youths?
His name is Steve Teske. He is a juvenile court judge in Clayton County, Georgia. Steve Teske is the first person in the country to do the work on school justice partnerships and to address the issue of kids being pushed out of school into court. He saw the problem happening in his county. Clayton County is a very poor county on the south side of Atlanta. His numbers in juvenile delinquent court went through the roof. He called some community people in, looked at finding a way to deal with that, and they had great success. I met Steve Teske at a national school partnership, school justice partnership summit in New York City. He spoke at a plenary, and I turned to my colleagues from North Carolina and said, we've got to do this work. And I went to a follow-up breakout session that he led, and I met him. And then just over a year later, he was here in New Hanover County helping our partnership get off the ground and help us do some strategic planning. I continue my contact with him. He and I are actually going to be co-presenting at a Governor's Crime Commission event in April. We co-presented at a National Institute on School Justice Partnerships in Charlotte, sponsored by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges just over a month ago. He's the person that changed my life about that. When I heard him talk about it, I said, this is happening to us, and we've got to do something different. Judge Elizabeth Trosh from Mecklenburg County was there. She did the same thing. She brought the same work back to Mecklenburg County. They're doing it too and have been since then. So Steve Teske is that person.
And what year was that again?
So I met him in 2012.
Okay.
We were going to start our partnership work in 2013. I'd already met with Tim Markley, who was then a fairly new superintendent. But then Sandy Hook happened, and my district attorney asked me to chair a Safer Schools Task Force to look at a broader picture of safety in schools, which took about a year. So then in 2014, we started this work in building our partnership, and now these partnerships are going statewide in North Carolina.
So what are the components of this partnership?
So it's a multidisciplinary group involving schools, justice, law enforcement, mental health, social services, come together to agree on factors of discipline, agree on purposes for responding to student misbehavior, but most importantly, to agree to keep kids in school and out of court and off the streets. I mean, that's really what's involved here, because as we push kids out of school and into court or on the streets, then we change our outcomes forever for the worse. There are really not any positive outcomes that come from either suspension or charging. Are there safety issues at times that we have to address? Yes, and safety has to be a focus. But these partnerships typically agree that for the first one or two of generally defined acts of misbehavior at school that are minor misconduct that lots of kids get into that are violations of our criminal law, that we'll find another way to respond to that other than charging.
Is that the graduated response model?
It is the graduated response model. And then as
another... So you start out with the idea of, say, a warning for a particular behavior.
Absolutely. And, you know, so people scoff at a warning.
Yeah.
So I'll ask the listeners if they've ever been riding down a road at night and all of a sudden their world turns blue and they glance down at their speedometer and may let out an expletive because they're driving too fast. and then all they can think as they're waiting on the side of the road is warning ticket, warning ticket, warning ticket. And then if that really happens, then there was a learning moment there.
Right. What if there's not? I mean, do you run into kids who just really don't care? Kids who've been hurt so much that a white guy coming at them and giving them a warning is just somewhat, they just don't want to see your face.
Sure. So yes. Are there kids who continue to get in trouble? Yes. But for most minor misconduct, learning can happen, and then we can avoid repetition of that conduct. For example, our teen court has great statistics on recidivism, and they track kids for a year. Now, if we're tracking adults, then we'd need to track longer than that. But teenagers, we're tracking them for a year. That's pretty good evidence that they're not going to get back into trouble.
What is teen court? How does that work?
So teen court is a program that exists lots of places. Unfortunately, doesn't exist in all counties in North Carolina. It's a peer-led response to student misconduct. The attorneys who work in the courtroom are students. The jurors are students. We have volunteer lawyers who preside over the teen court. I'm proud that my daughter is one of those volunteer lawyers who presides. And then the case is presented, the teenager has accepted responsibility for the misconduct. The case is presented, and then the jury, literally of their peers, decides on what their punishment is going to be in terms of community service. And there's a range of community service options in terms of hours that the jury can decide on.
So other than that kid who is on trial, other than the fact that he won't have an actual criminal conviction, how does that change his trajectory? I mean, how does that change his thinking or his behavior in the world? What does he learn from that experience?
I've watched teen court work. There's a certain amount of magic involved in the fact that it's teenagers that are dealing with the issue as opposed to adults, because the young person sees his friends or his peers making the decision about what happens, and then they serve their community service. Most of the kids that we see are grateful for that opportunity. Their families are grateful for that opportunity, and we see changed behavior as a result. One of the things that I love about teen court is not just the impact on the kids who have committed an offense, who, by the way, then have to come back and serve on jury duty as part of their punishment, but the kids who come and volunteer. You mentioned a number earlier. We actually had 185 at one teen court session volunteering last year, actually earlier this year in February. 185 teenage volunteers there to work in four courtrooms. We've served about 61 kids in trouble so far this year in teen court. But we have over 100 volunteers there. And it's a great experience for them to take part in that kind of process where they're dealing with their peers.
And so they not only learn about the workings of the judicial system, but it sounds like they're also learning empathy.
They do learn empathy, and they learn responsibility, and they see these young people coming through who have made a mistake. And I think they're recognizing that that could have been me.
Yeah.
And that's an important first step in empathy, is that that could have been me. Because as we seek to judge people, typically we're judging them for things that, and I'm not talking about decision-making in the court system, but as we judge people for who they are, what they are, we should be hesitant to do that. If we understood their circumstances, if we sought to understand what's really happening, then we would have a different feeling about them. And I think teen court helps that, and it's an important first step in empathy. It's a great program. We're hopeful that as part of Raise the Age, we're going to be able to take teen court statewide as well.
We have an email. Brian from Wilmington writes, "I'd like to thank Judge Korpening for his progressive approach to law enforcement. I would like his opinion on the war on drugs in general as a vehicle to prison for minorities and low-income citizens alike." Brian writes, "In my opinion, education, prevention, and harm reduction are the answer, not punitive action, criminal records, and incarceration, which lead to an increase in the severity of future crimes."
So as we respond to addicts in particular in the criminal justice system, treatment is the answer, not incarceration. There's some sentencing reform going on right now in the General Assembly. I'm optimistic about that reform. I'm not closely involved in that. I can't have my fingers on everything that's going on.
lot of people here think you can.
But I know that that's going on. But I think that as we respond to addicts, and I'm not talking about traffickers, I'm talking about addicts,
right,
who are users who may be selling to support their habit, we've got to respond differently, and we've got to make sure they get the treatment that they need. And we can play a role in connecting them to that treatment. We also need to bring back drug treatment courts statewide. Our General Assembly canceled treatment courts, canceled funding for treatment courts a number of years ago at a time when nationally they were going around the country. Ours got canceled at a time when Chris Christie took them statewide in New Jersey. Ours got canceled. Now, through local initiatives, we've been able to maintain 22 treatment courts in the 44 judicial districts in North Carolina through either grant funding or county funding, different funding mechanisms. But it's a state responsibility, and if we're going to respond to the needs of these addicts and to make their lives better, to keep them out of prison, to make them productive, then we need treatment courts back.
An email from Steve. He writes, "The community is indeed fortunate to have Jay Korpening as Chief District Court Judge. I had the honor of being one of his assistant scout masters at the 1997 National Scout Jamboree and recognized his great care and concern for young people. He continues to be a great role model for youth and adults alike."
Thanks, Steve. Good to hear from you.
And an email from Tom. "Where might a local resident participate with community restorative justice programs?"
You know, unfortunately, I don't think we have community restorative justice programs yet. There's a great forum at the Hannah Block Center this weekend about lots of different things the community can do. It starts at 9:30 at the Hannah Block Center. Lots of different topics, including Raise the Age. But there's a variety of topics, and that'd be a great first place to start. There are going to be some folks who are connected to restorative justice that will be there. We're looking to grow the role of restorative justice in our schools, but also in our community. It's such a great model, such a powerful model.
And we will post that information on our website at the conclusion of this discussion. An email from David, who writes, "This was a story you featured some weeks ago. It was a tweet from a man in the wake of the Parkland shooting. He talked about our young men of any color and how something terrible has gone wrong. David writes, they are mad, they are angry, and they are acting out with greater frequency. I'm in a men's fitness group that meets regularly, and we talk about the lack of old world male to young male mentoring to help with positive behaviors. How would you respond, Judge Korpening?"
I agree. There are lots of unmet needs that lots of our young people who decide to take up guns and go into schools and shoot, lots of unmet needs, both in their family and their mental health. I've had the privilege of getting to know a guy named Larry Bonney, who's a retired FBI agent, lives here locally, is actually a substitute teacher. Larry investigated school shootings for the FBI. Larry was a founding member of the hostage rescue team for the FBI. Larry talks about the importance of relationships inside the school building and taking care of those relationships. Every kid needs somebody to talk to in a building. Larry interviewed some kids who were surviving shooters. Typically, kids don't survive who shoot. They either commit suicide or they die suicide by cop. And the kids that Larry interviewed said, I just needed somebody to talk to. Our job is to give them somebody to talk to. That's why I'm pushing mental health in every school. That's why I'm pushing youth mental health first aid training. I think that as we take care of the mental health of the young people in our schools, then we can at least be on the alert for, yes, maybe this kid doesn't have a positive male role model, but there's more going on and there are risk factors.
In U.S. public schools today, estimates say there's one school psychologist for every 1,381 students. The National Association of School Psychologists recommends one psychologist for every 500 to 700 students. How do we compare locally?
We've made progress in the last few years. We had a great roundtable discussion that Chairman Woody White called just a couple of weeks ago. And there is renewed commitment to expand mental health services in schools. And the mental health services in schools are sort of a complicated picture because it's not just school psychologists, but it's also school mental health therapists. Lots of our school psychologists are actually doing educational testing full time. So they're not actually necessarily seeing kids for psychological issues, but we have licensed mental health counselors who are in some of our schools. I think there are 13 that are employed by New Hanover County Health Department that are based in our schools that see kids on a regular basis. We've got to grow both of those numbers. I've advocated for over 5 years that they be expanded to caseloads according to national standards. National standards exist for a reason, and safety is a big part of that reason. I think we need to have staffing according to national standards for both school psychologists, for school-based mental health therapists, for guidance counselors, for school social workers, and school nurses. All of those folks within the student support services realm have an impact on making things better for kids, and I think as a result have an impact on school safety.
At that meeting to discuss school safety that you referred to, that Woody White convened, there was discussion about training cafeteria workers and custodians on mental health issues. And frankly, I heard somebody off the record kind of chuckle about that.
So I can respond because school cafeterias workers and custodians see the kids more frequently than anybody else in the building. They see them every day. They see them every day for every year that kid is in school, not just for one class semester. They are in a position to see changes in behavior that maybe nobody else sees. I'm a believer that they're an important part of the team and that they need the training too.
Okay, so can you give us two or three red flags or things that your average person out in the community could look for when they come into contact with kids every day?
So significant changes in behavior, particularly kids who are normally outgoing, who are withdrawn, who start lashing out instead of being good-natured. Any significant change of behavior could be a warning sign of something more serious happening. And that's why the Youth Mental Health First Aid training is so important.
Judge Korpening, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Caitlin Hanrahan, today's chief engineer, Caroline DeVries, is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.